Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And do not forget that debt is fraud. And we've got Tammy back with us. Thank you so much, Tammy, for taking this time and going and joining me on this journey of enlightenment, education, whatever you want to call it. But we're going to start over again, not from the very beginning, but I want to go back to where Madison said, "I, sir, have always conceived." But before we do, and the reason why we're doing this is those who were listening yesterday, but they may not be listening, or those who are listening today that didn't listen yesterday, it is imperative that we constantly harangue the American public in understanding the importance of how the Constitution was stipulated, how they understood this Constitution to mean. Because this is why Madison keeps on doing this. He keeps on referring to the ratification debates. This isn't a coincidence. This is the fundamental tenets of contract law. When you have stipulated the contract to mean very specific things, and then you want to deviate away from that. You know, we listen to people today like Rand Paul, who uses lip service to this limited and defined government, but doesn't actually go into a rant on all of the tyranny that the government is basically imposing upon the people and its taxation and this debt that is all fraudulent. So, to me, I think it's really important that we do cover this, because every time, you know, when they want to consider in Congress a bill, when they want to consider, you know, doing something, they need to consider how was the Constitution sold.
Yeah.
Any points on that you want to add?
Well, it's interesting to me that even back then there were questions about the Common Defense and General Welfare Clause, and they just ratified it, and they were already having questions about it.
Or they were already trying to bend it, right, to create advantages so that they could get reelected. Just remember, I brought you money from D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how people, oh, yes, you're great. You've helped us. Their job isn't to help you. Their job is to support the Constitution in its true meaning. And when they do that, they are supporting you because they're allowing you to be unfettered by government so that you can actually be self-sufficient and self-sustaining and working in your community so that you guys can figure out how to move forward. And so, anyway, right, this becomes so imperative, which is why I think it's imperative that they, you know, we repeat these very beginning words of, "I, sir, have always conceived." So go ahead and let's start it from there.
Okay. "I, sir, have always conceived. I believe those who proposed the Constitution conceived. It is still more fully known and more material to observe those who ratified the Constitution conceived that this is not an indefinite government deriving its powers from the general terms prefixed to the specified powers, but a limited government tied down to the specified powers which explain and define the general terms. The gentlemen who contend for a contrary doctrine are surely not aware of the consequences which flow from it, and which they must either admit or give up their doctrine."
Okay, keep going.
"It will follow, in the first place, that if the terms be taken in the broad sense, It will follow, in the first place, that if the terms be taken in the broad sense they maintain, the particular powers afterwards, so carefully and distinctly enumerated, would be without meaning and must go for nothing."
Okay, so again, like I said this yesterday, when they talk about the General Defense and Welfare Clause, that is the preamble of the Constitution. And so when we look at that preamble basically states that Congress is going to have the power to lay tax or lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. Now, when they say taxes and then they say imposts and excises and duties, actually, duties is a form of tax. Duties is direct tax. Impost is a specific tax on products being shipped into America. And excises is kind of like a sales tax. When you buy something, there's a little, you know, tribute to the government, like, you know, gas is an excise tax, cigarettes and so forth, liquor. Those are direct taxes that we pay to help fund government. Just keep in mind that for years and years, the majority of the money that the government made was literally from imposts, because America was consuming goods and they would levy a tax on those goods coming in. And in so doing, it made it harder for us to continually buy foreign goods when we could manufacture and eventually took over and became producers of those things that they were basically taxing. So as we move forward in this preamble, and it says, and provide for, to pay debts and provide for. So again, they're laying taxes and to pay debts. All of this is to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, excises, all of these taxes, direct tax, imposts, and excise taxes, shall be uniform throughout the United States. And so I'm going to harangue on this just because I didn't do this yesterday. When we look at direct tax, income tax, it says right here, it shall be uniform throughout the United States, which means if you're paying a federal income tax, you pay the same thing that you that everybody else pays on their income. The idea of a progressive income tax is unconstitutional. The Sixth Amendment did not address the uniformity clause. They never mentioned anything. They basically said that we're no longer going to basically lay taxes to the states on apportionment. We're going to directly tax your income. Okay, so the amendment passed, directly tax our income, but it has to be uniform. And so when they actually started creating progressive taxes, they were able to take more from those and actually benefited people in the very beginning to actually help people that didn't make money and made them actually shills, or I will just say dependents on government welfare. And it was a huge transition of creating something that they had no power to create. They couldn't do that. Everybody, even the poor, would have to pay tax. But today, the way they play it and the way they create these write-offs and, oh, if you don't make enough money, then you don't pay tax, that's not uniform.
Yeah.
And bottom line, this is how they've redefined all of these things. Okay, so but Madison basically says, okay, so here's this general clause out there, but now we've affixed the very specific purposes as to why we're taxing and spending money. To borrow money for the credit of the United States, to regulate commerce with foreign nations. So they need a little bit of money to actually create this regulation service to ensure that they're putting proper imposts on stuff coming in. They can't do it blindly, so they have to actually put people in ports and actually have to pay them. So that costs money, and for them to cost that, to be able to spend that money and capture that money more efficiently, you know, so that they can, you know, put the imposts on the goods coming in so that they can pay the debt. So in other words, this was all kind of creating this layout of how they had to function, going through listing these things that they had to do. The enumerations are the powers. This general defense, or the common defense and general welfare clause in the preamble, is not a power. It is an explanation of why these following powers have been granted. Okay, so This is what he just basically says. The particular powers afterwards so carefully and distinctly enumerated would be without meaning and must go for nothing if they basically could only take the General Defense and Welfare Clause in a very broad sense that, oh, well, we can do whatever we want to. No. You can only do those things that we enumerated. Okay, so go ahead.
Yeah, so the common defense and general welfare within the enumerated powers, basically, right?
That is correct. Yes, so that they only had this common defense and general welfare was basically a declaration of why these powers are being given, right? To create and maintain a Navy for the common defense and general welfare. To be able to call forth the militia for a common defense and general welfare, to regulate commerce among the nations and to regulate commerce among the states and with Indians. And so as they listed these things, each of those lines, if you just added an affixed to the back of each of those lines for the common defense and general welfare, then you don't have to repeat it. The preamble basically says this is we've got this general power of taxation for the common defense and general welfare, and it's going to basically fund these things. So had they just broken up the preamble and added extra words for each power delegated, then it would not have been able to take this life that they actually, you know, have made out of this. But the fact of the matter is, during the ratification debates, they clarified this to ad nauseum because it was constantly brought up in those states who were trying to kill the Constitution that right there is a power. They said, no, it's not. That is not a general power. It is a preamble. It's basically a declaration as to why the foregoing powers are provided. Which is exactly why he said that if they maintain this sense, this broad sense of these particular powers in this preamble, that afterwards the so carefully enumerated powers would actually have no meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so go ahead.
Yeah, and the Constitution would be worthless. So
that's right. So go ahead.
It would be absurd to say first that Congress may do what they please and then that they may do this on that particular thing. After giving Congress power to raise money and apply it to all purposes which they may pronounce necessary to the general welfare, it would be absurd, to say the least, to superadd a power to raise armies, to provide fleets, etc. In fact, that the meaning of the general terms in question must either be sought in the subsequent enumerations which limits and details them, or they convert the government from one limited, as hitherto supposed, to the enumerated powers into a government without any limits at all.
So you see what he's saying here? He's basically saying because these enumerations are actually the stipulate, or we're clearly laying out that these are the only things they can do, and if you continue with what you're saying, then we've created a government without any limits at all. And that's not what we did. And that's not what the states believe. So go ahead.
It is to be recollected that the terms common defense and general welfare are here used are not novel terms first introduced into this Constitution. They are terms familiar in their construction and well known to the people of America. They are repeatedly found in the old Articles of Confederation, where although they are susceptible of as great latitude as can be given them by the context here, it was never supposed or pretended that they conveyed any such powers as is now assigned to them.
So,
on the contrary.
So I'll just stop you right there. So basically what he just said is we basically used the same language in the Articles of Confederation that they created this confederacy for this general defense and welfare of the Union. And that, you know, that Congress, Continental Congress, was going to have these very and he says it was never contended, never, because they didn't have, they knew the Continental Congress didn't have the power to coerce the states to pay him. But now all of a sudden, because the government has the power to coerce states to pay, now we actually can basically convert how we understood this language to actually, you know, place context to it, right? I mean, what? They couldn't presume and they couldn't say that we could just do these things because they knew they couldn't get the money. But now that the federal government, right, they want to redefine it, so, hey, we're an unlimited and undefined anymore. And that's not the case. As a matter of fact, the Constitution was sold more specifically because there weren't as many general powers granted to it as Continental Congress had. The only difference was Continental Congress didn't have the energy, the power in the Articles of Confederation to coerce the states to get that money, which is one of the reasons why the Constitution was very well articulated in defining these very specific roles, responsibilities, powers, and properties. So anyway, so as he just lays this out here, that the whole point is that nobody ever made this misconstruction. And now that we have the ability to actually obtain money from the states, now we're going to use latitude? Well, that was never the intention. As a matter of fact, we actually framed these things in such a way to make it impossible to create general powers. We even said in the ratification debates, Randolph said it, Madison said it, it was stated in many of the states in the ratification process that there are no general powers. The powers are clear and defined and enumerated and limited. And it was even sold in South Carolina as a power of attorney, a specified limited power of attorney, not a general power of attorney. So anyway, I it's important to drag this dead horse because Madison is up here schooling these people and basically lecturing them on the fact that they do not have the general powers to basically play with people's money using the public purse to do these things. So go ahead and pick it up with the I ask.
Okay.
In the black part.
I think I actually ended.
Yeah, you said explained in the general terms, and then you didn't read, I asked the gentleman themselves.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I asked the gentleman themselves whether it ever was supposed or suspected that the old Congress could give away the money of the states in bounties to encourage agriculture or for any other purpose they pleased. If such a power had been possessed by that body, it would have been much less impotent or have borne a very different character from that universally ascribed to it.
Okay, keep going, because now he's actually going to say, okay, now we're going to entertain some ideas here. So go ahead.
The novel idea now annexed to those terms and never before entertained by the friends or enemies of the government will have a further consequence which cannot have been taken into the view of the gentlemen. Their construction would not only give Congress the complete legislative power I have stated, it would do more. It would supersede all the restrictions understood at present to lie on their power with respect to a judiciary. It would put in the power of Congress to establish courts throughout the United States, which cognizance of suits between citizen and citizen, and in all cases whatsoever. This, sir, seems to be demonstrable. For if the clause in question really authorizes Congress to do whatever they think fit, provided it be for the general welfare of which they are to judge and money can be applied to it, Congress must have power to create and support a judiciary establishment with a jurisdiction extending to all cases favorable in their opinion to the general welfare in the same manner as they have power to pass laws and apply money, providing in any other way for the general welfare.
Okay. Thank you. I wanted to catch it right there. So basically he's saying that here's something you haven't even considered. Now that we can actually use money however we want to, well, then we're going to need to have a court to actually ensure that people are following what we want them to do. So in other words, this is where the Congress, the legislative branch, would actually subvert the judiciary and use the judiciary to govern. creating. In other words, he's basically laying out the recipe of how to create a very strong judiciary of regulating and actually going down the path of even legislating. This is how they were going to, and this, you kind of like what Mason did in the ratification debates, which you missed, how Mason identified the recipe or the process of how the federal government could marginalize the importance of the militia, just like they marginalized the Navy, and going down that path of marginalizing, what they were going to do was basically make it impossible, or make it impossible for the militia to be even able to function. And in this particular case, Madison's laying the recipe of how it creates this want and desire to create courts in every state to basically, you know, handle all cases of law and the spending of money. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. And we got 3 minutes, so let's see if we can get through what we can.
Go ahead. I shall be reminded, perhaps, that according to the terms of the Constitution, the judicial power is to extend to certain cases only, not to all cases. But this circumstance can have no effect in the argument, it being presupposed by the gentleman that the specification of certain objects does not limit the import of the general terms. Taking these terms as an abstract and indefinite grant of power, they compromise all the objects of legislative regulation, as well such as fall under the judiciary article in the Constitution, as those falling immediately under the legislative article. And if the partial enumeration of objects in the legislative article does not, as these gentlemen contend, limit the general power, neither will it be limited by the partial enumeration of objects in the judiciary article.
Okay, so right there, we got 2 minutes left. Obviously, I'm doing a little better due diligence in maintaining this. So now he actually is really going to start backslapping him. He's going to slap him, backslap him, and then he's going to forward slap him. It's just back and forth. And you can just see Congress's heads going one way and then the next way. Because here you go, there are consequences still more, so keep going.
There are consequences, sir, still more extensive, which, as they follow clearly from the doctrine combated, must either be admitted or the doctrine must be given up.
And if so Congress... he already said that a couple of paragraphs above. He basically says, you guys either have to admit this, you know, that this is what's going to happen, or you have to give this up, because this is what's going to happen. Either you admit it and stop doing this, or you're moving forward and this is what you're trying to do. So in other words, he wants to make them own their decision if they're going to actually misconstrue this part of the Constitution. And so we basically have a minute. So what we've covered so far, any questions, any comments?
No questions. I mean,
it's pretty straightforward, but not knowing and not ever learning this stuff, you realize that we've been basically co-opted by a political system where compromise is the rule of the day. The Democrats and the Republicans compromised, or they agreed that you'll get this and they'll get that. And this is what we've got. In other words, we live in a government that knows no bounds.
Yeah.
Right. So with that, we've basically got 10 seconds left. So when we come back, we'll pick up right where you left off. And again, just keep this metaphor, keep this imagery in your head as Madison basically, you know, swipes at them with, you know, going down this one path of saying, well, this is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen. And this is what's going to happen. You can just kind of see how the heads in Congress go snap back and forth as he's laying this out. This is one of the most powerful debates where they just dive into this one very specific thing, the common defense and the general defense and welfare of the United States. So we'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we kind of dive into Madison really laying it out for them, go ahead.
Yeah, so this next part,
yes,
is really good because he lays it out.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so go ahead and lead it off with the beginning of the paragraph again. Go ahead.
Their consequences are still more extensive, which, as they follow clearly from the doctrine combated, must either be admitted or the doctrine must be given up. If Congress can apply money indefinitely to the general welfare and are the sole and supreme judges of the general welfare, they may take the care of religion into their own hands. They may establish teachers in every state.
Okay, so hold on here. There's these little semicolons. So The first thing he does is he whap. They may take the care of religion into their own hands. Whap. Then the next one, which is
they may establish teachers in every state, county, and parish, and pay them out of the public treasury.
Whack. The heads go back the other way. Now the next one.
They may take into their own hands the education of children, establishing in like manner schools throughout the Union.
Whack! Go ahead.
They may assume the provision of the poor.
Whack!
They may undertake the regulation of all roads other than post roads.
Whack!
In short, everything.
So he basically is, at this point in time, they could only fathom these things. They weren't even thinking health care, housing, labor, on and on, you know, environment, energy, right? I mean, at this point in time, government was just kind of limited, and this was the heart and soul of society was religion and education and the roads and that type of stuff, just simple things. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, keep going.
All right, so in short, everything from the highest object of state legislation down to the most minute object of police would be thrown under the power of Congress. For every object I have mentioned would admit the application of money and might be called, if Congress pleased, provisions for the general welfare.
Okay, so you can see how all of a sudden, you know, these men understanding, that's just, so keep in mind that there are men in these rooms that may have these common bounds, or I should say, these associations, these direct associations of what they're doing. They're not common. In other words, there are men in this room that have slaves, and there are men in this room without slaves. And if all of a sudden they go down this path, what Madison is saying is everything gets taken over and government will now dictate where you will lose your right of conscience to not have slaves. You'll lose your right of conscience to be able to exercise your own religion, such as the Puritans. the Puritans really took to heart the importance of their religious expression. I mean, they created a colony over the, you know, and they left England over religious oppression. And so they came here, they created their own state based on their own faith, and now they could lose that. Does that make sense? I mean, these men were, you know, very incensed with having their own self-destiny as a sovereign state and having these independences. Now, Madison just basically says what you're doing will lead to rocking your own world.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
So the language held in various discussions of this house is it proof that the doctrine in question was never entertained by this body. Arguments, wherever the subject would permit, have constantly been drawn from the peculiar nature of this government as limited to certain enumerated powers, instead of extending, like other governments, to all cases not particularly accepted.
There you go. So, in other words, he's right here. You could really place context to the fact that he's speaking of powers of attorney. And by saying that, he's basically saying that the language in the Constitution was enumerated and specified that the government only had limited and specified powers, as one would do in a power of attorney. All other governments in the world, even to this day, have general powers. The powers are left to the government themselves. Now, there's only one unique state out there, and that is Britain. Britain actually has this thing called the Bill of Rights. Now, all other nations kind of fall under the UN with these, you know, declarations of humanity or whatever, this crap. But those are not instilled to where government cannot infringe upon these very specific rights. The question is, what happened to Britain? Because are you familiar with what's going on today? How Britain is basically allowing the immigrants to basically take over, take their property, and any British person that actually speaks out against this invasion of these immigrants are actually being hauled away into jail, whether it's in social media or what have you. And actually, I don't know if you knew, but Britain basically has even threatened Americans for speaking out that they'll come capture us and throw us in jail. Have you heard that?
I did not know that.
Yes.
No, I hadn't heard that.
They're getting very aggressive, this globalist government, and this is happening throughout Europe. But the reason this is important about Britain is because in Britain, Britain actually has these things called the Bill of Rights. And so let me see if I've got my citations available. So what I'm going to do is actually just read out of this, because in selling the Constitution, George Nicholas basically laid out the difference between this Constitution and Britain. Britain still had a layer of protection. As I say, no other nation had the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights. So what George Nicholas said, in England, quote, in England, in all disputes between the king and people, recurrence, or, you know, the process, is had to the enumerated rights of the people to determine. Are the rights in dispute secured? Are they included in the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, and etc.? If not, they are generally speaking within the king's prerogative, the general government's prerogative. And in disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. Is the disputed right enumerated? If not, Congress cannot meddle with it. So in other words, we didn't need a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights really provides us nothing other than today, as I tell people, the only way the Bill of Rights protects us is from our own states, because the 14th Amendment applied the protections under the Constitution to keep the federal government from doing these things, now applied to the states, which is why Article Section 1 of the 14th Amendment states that no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. In other words, those privileges and immunities guaranteed by that Constitution. So they can't make a law that denies us to be secure in our persons, or make a law that denies us our freedom of religious expression, or denies us our ability to survive and make commerce. You know, these enumerations that cannot be construed to deny or disparage the people of their rights, maybe not enumerated. So this Constitution, and as Madison's really laying it out here, you know, we are literally going to turn this government into what the rest of the world has. And that's not legitimate. And actually, what he doesn't say here, I don't think, is he doesn't dive into the fact that the states have and can actually descend upon us and stop us. Again, this goes back to, you know, the subversion and the misdirection of government. In the very beginning, he was basically doing a great job in trying to keep these people in check. When 1798 came around, he was no longer in Congress. He was a private citizen. Thomas Jefferson was the vice president. And we're going to get into those this week, maybe this week or next. But the point is this, is that when we look at this, you know, what he's talking about here, he doesn't bring up the fact of what they end up having to do in 1798 because they felt desperate. They felt that the Alien Sedition Acts was such a breach of understanding this Constitution, granting the federal government the ability to pass these oppressive types of laws. Then they said, gee, we got to stop this. We got to do something about this. So keep going. Go ahead now.
Okay. The language held in various discussions of this house. Did I already read that?
Yes, so you're on the super text here now.
Okay. In a very late instance, I mean the debate on the representation bill, it must be remembered that an argument much used, particularly by a gentleman from Massachusetts, against the ratio of 1 for 30,000 was that this government was unlike the state governments, which had an indefinite variety of objects within their power, that it had a small number of objects only to attend to, and therefore that a smaller number of representatives would be sufficient to administer it.
There you go. So remember, he's now pointing out that, hey, you know, we have a small number of representatives. How many people are represented in the states, in the state governments? And as a matter of fact, I will go to New Hampshire. If you look at the New Hampshire representation, I believe it's something like one representative for every 3,000 people. The federal government was 1 to 30,000, so they didn't need to have hundreds of people in Congress because it was to be small, limited, and defined. If they're actually going to start representing more, then they actually, based on this apportionment, they would have had to increase because the federal government would have to work more. They would have needed more representation. What Congress technically did over the course of its expanding its powers, it created positions, aides, and I'll call them secretaries or what have you, that could, basically every congressperson employs about 20 people, and these aides are empowered to do certain things. And in other words, instead of actually giving you a representative out of all of those 20-some people in that office, you only have one representative. And those other people doing things are not accountable to you. So keep going. Keep going.
Okay. Arguments have been advanced to shew that because, in the regulation of trade, indirect and eventual encouragement is given to manufacturers, therefore Congress have power to give money in direct bounties or to grant it in any other way that would answer the same purpose. But surely, sir, there is a great and obvious difference, which it cannot be necessary to enlarge upon. A duty laid on imported implements of husbandry would in its operations be an indirect tax on exported produce. But will anyone say that by virtue of a mere power to lay duties on imports, Congress might go directly to the produce or implements of agriculture, or to the articles exported? It is true, duties on exports are expressly prohibited, but if there were no article forbidding them, a power directly to tax exports could never be deduced from a power to tax imports, although such a power might indirectly and incidentally affect exports.
And so, actually, and if we look at the income tax and the ability to lay income tax on corporations, in other words, we're taxing their profits, Madison just points out how that is a tax on exportation. Because if General Motors is making bank on, you know, producing and selling cars abroad, that 30% tax that they levy are up to 40% at some times. I think it's 28 now or 30. Nevertheless, that 30% tax has to be added to the cost of their products for us to buy, as well as for what we're competing in the world market for. In other words, this direct tax literally backdoored Congress's inability to tax corporations and exports. And in so doing, they made foreign goods more attractive for us to buy. And basically, we became the consumers of world goods. And we subsidized the building of China and the war machine that it has today. Go ahead. Go ahead and keep going.
In short, sir, without going further into the subject, which I should not have here touched on at all, but for the reasons already mentioned, I venture to declare it as my opinion that were the power of Congress to be established in the latitude contended for, it would subvert the very foundation and transmute the very nature of the limited government established by the people of America. And what inferences might be drawn or what consequences ensue from such a step, it is incumbent on us all well to consider. With respect to the question before the House for striking out the clause, it is immaterial whether it be struck out or so amended as to the rest on the avowed principle of a commutation for the drawback, but as a clause has been drawn up by one of my colleagues in order to be substituted, I shall concur in a vote for striking out, reserving to myself a freedom to be governed in my final vote by the modification which may prevail.
Okay, so as we kind of look at, you know, what basically Madison said, he's voting against it. I don't know what anybody else around here is going to do, but I'm going to vote against this, okay? And so he kind of marches forward with, you know, that kind of lays that out there, and so everybody can kind of digest that. Now, what we're going to do, because we still have a little time left, do you have any remaining comments or anything, go backs or something we didn't cover?
I don't.
You don't. That's okay. So what I pulled up is the Coinage Act, because this is actually just a couple months later. Now, up to this point in time, Congress has yet to really delineate this financial plan of creating a stable currency, a specie, you know, actual tangible money that people could actually have that could, you know, it's hard to inflate. You know, you can print paper. And the reason why we went through this in the ratification debates this year and last year, that when you have paper, it has no value. And so they knew that America needed to have a stable currency and to maintain, and that's why it's in the Constitution, to maintain the value thereof. Go ahead.
Oh, are we reading the Coinage Act?
So, yeah, the Coinage Act. Well, actually, what I'm going to do, we're not going to read through this because this is several pages, but what I want to do is I want to actually highlight some parts out of the Coinage Act that actually kind of really jump out, and it basically talks about the enumeration of, you know, the money and so forth, and when they get into the Coinage Act, they actually talk about how they're going to create these standards. And I think it's right here in Section 9. And so if you want to, let me go ahead and read this because I don't know how visible it is for you.
Because it's folks, pretty small.
It's pretty small. So And it be further enacted. So this is Section 9. And to be further enacted, that there shall be from time to time struck and coined at the said mint coins of gold, silver, and copper. Now, the Constitution did not include copper. One of the things that they realize is if they're going to, you know, have gold and silver, those are one, the rare commodities, but for them to have their value, they needed to have a specie or a medium that would actually make it easier to where the common currency would be the penny, you know, and a half penny and those types of things. And as a matter of fact, this was very similar to how Britain had minted its gold and silver and pennies as well. I don't know if they had copper or what, but nevertheless, of the following denomination values and descriptions, these eagles, each to be of the value of $10. So a gold eagle would be a $10 unit or contain 247 grains. So now they're actually talking about the actual weight value, the quality of the gold. So unlike Britain is basically they have a gold coin. And the common thing, and this has been brought up historically, how governments have stolen the wealth from the people because they create this coinage and everybody has this. They start playing with the purity of the gold by extracting half the gold out of the coin to where they're putting lead or some other alloy mixed with the gold. So you still have a gold coin, but it's really only worth half its value. And the king is sitting on half of the nation's wealth.
Right.
And so they wanted to make sure that they maintained a quality standard by law. And so that's exactly what they did. Now, one of the things that I would tell you, the listeners, you may want to read our digital currency petition 7 that's up on Reclaiming the Republic's petition page, because we really dive into the details of why this is so important. But what I wanted to do is just kind of give you this glimpse of how they did this. And as a matter of fact, here's the beauty of this bill. If you have gold, such as, you know, gold necklaces, gold jewelry, or you find gold on your property. See, this did not create a mineral rights that the United States owns all gold. No. Basically, what it did was it said, if you mine gold, you can bring it to a mint, and you will, for the weight of the gold that you give us and the purity of that, we will give you equal gold in coinage. In other words, this is how the government got an exchange so that you could get your gold and silver converted from your mining into, you know, a $10 coin.
Mm-hmm.
So that you didn't just have this commodity that wasn't usable. You now had a recognized specie. The fact of the matter is that when we look at the way and what they were doing, they made it so that there was no capturing in the price of the coinage. In other words, when you go to the mint today and you look at the cost of gold by the commodity, let's just say gold is an even $2,000, that if you went and bought gold, a gold coin, from a dealer, the dealer would probably sell it to you for $2,000 because that's the price. If they were going to buy it from you, they would buy it from you at a discount. In other words, you know, why would they pay you what they're selling it for? So in other words, it's kind of like if I'm going to trade in on your car, I'm not going to give you the full value. I'm going to mark it down a little bit, or I'm going to pay you less.
Right.
Because I have to, you know, you're coming to me and you got to pay for these services, this building and so forth. But when you look at the mint actually is selling gold and they're capturing the price of government. In other words, you're not paying $2,000 for a silver coin. You're paying probably $2,500 or $3,000 for that $2,000 coin.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, they guaranteed a straight commuting. In other words, what you gave in weight, you would receive back in weight. And so if you gave them, you know, this odd number of gold, you know, pure gold, and it didn't come to a full ounce or what have you, then they would give you a little bit of silver or copper to basically, now you'd walk away with the full value of what you turned in.
Right.
That's how they stimulated the growth of their species. Because as the money got out, see, the government wasn't to keep the money. The government was actually to take care of the value of the money. They're not to be the bank. Again, right. this goes back to before the bank even happened. So going through this, and we could easily spend probably a long period of time. I need to check. We got about 3 minutes left. So let me get back to this little diatribe on what they're talking about in this act. He says, okay, so let me go jump down to half eagles, each to be of the value of $5 and contain 123 grains. So they're, again, going through the ounce. The quarter eagles, which would be the value to $2 and a half. And so obviously they're breaking it down, 10, half, and 250. They're going down and creating the denominations of coins. And they realized that if you were going to have $100, that would be 10 coins of gold in your pocket, and that would probably wear out your pants pretty quick. And the fact is that what they wanted to do was they wanted to create such a strong value that the majority of your spending, when you walked around, you'd only have a few pennies in your pocket. They didn't have nickel at this point in time, but they had to create nickel because all of a sudden they needed another medium between copper and silver, something that had a little bit better value than copper, but not the same value as silver. The intent was to avoid people walking around with a bunch of gold and silver on them. They would only have the things you needed to spend on today. And again, right. let's go back to $170 for a ship to be able to maintain its business out of a year to determine whether it was going to be profitable or lose money. Remember, we talked about this yesterday in the cod fishery bounties, and which we wrapped up today. But the point is that $170 is nothing. And so we're talking about 17 gold pieces. That would be a year's worth of profit. In other words, the value of things back in those days was so little that, you know, pennies and maybe a silver dollar for the large, you know, okay, we're going to pay for this and a bunch of other stuff. But back in those days, they tried to maintain a reasonable physical species so that you weren't having to carry a chest around. And the value of it was able to maintain that to where things were really kept at the penny and then necessarily the nickel. And then they came in with the dime because they started breaking gold, you know, so gold maintained and actually started growing in value, and silver actually started expanding. So as they started taking the silver down into quarters and started taking the quarters down into dimes, and then they introduced nickels and so forth, they grew our currency and they maintained its value, which is the whole point of the constitutional requirement. Anyway, so when we come back tomorrow, we're going to dive into the Whiskey Rebellion and move forward. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.